From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, if you've seen it or just heard about it, everybody's talking about the Michael Jackson documentary Leaving Neverland. We'll hear from its director. Then Robert Mapplethorpe's explicit photography has divided people for decades. Now it's the focus of a new work by composer Bryce Dessner, directed by Kaneza Shaw.
Finding ways to enter that as Black artists, as woman artists, as queer artists, is part of what excites me about the project.
And we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the strange musical instrument, the theremin. All that coming up on The Frame. Last night, part one of the documentary Leaving Neverland premiered on HBO. In it, filmmaker Dan Reed profiles two men who claim that Michael Jackson sexually abused them for years when they were children. Part two of Leaving Neverland airs tonight. The men in the film are Wade Robson, who's now 36, and James Safechuck, who is now 40. Robson met Jackson when he was 5 years old after winning a dance contest. Safechuck met Jackson when the two of them acted in a Pepsi commercial together when James was 10. Both of their mothers also appear in the film. Last week, the estate of Michael Jackson, which has attacked the documentary, sued HBO, saying it violated a non-disparagement clause in a contract for an earlier Jackson concert film. Much of the alleged sexual abuse, which is sometimes recounted in graphic detail, happened at Neverland. That's Jackson's former Santa Barbara area compound with a 12,000-square-foot main house on a 2,700-acre ranch that included a private zoo and amusement park rides. Dan Reed is the director of the documentary Leaving Neverland.
Leaving Neverland is a film about two young men coming to terms with what happened to them at Neverland, and it's kind of escape from Neverland story, and it's about how they managed to extricate themselves from the mental clutches of a pedophile who had ingratiated himself and insinuated himself into their lives and the lives of their families.
The four-hour documentary is largely focused on how Michael Jackson, who died in 2009, brought the boys into his life. It started with seemingly innocent invitations, but soon the boys were allegedly spending nights with Jackson as they were showered with gifts and told to keep secrets. And those secrets, the documentary says, included sexual abuse committed by Jackson. It's a pattern of behavior that experts in pedophilia call grooming, and it's not unlike how a Catholic priest might select and start assaulting a young altar boy.
You know, the kind of relationship a grooming predator forms with the victim is not perceived as abuse. It's perceived, it feels good. It's you know, the child feels valued. The predator lavishes attention and love and gifts and, you know, everything on the child. And so to the child, nothing bad's happening. It's just a secret that they have to keep because the abuser tells them to keep it secret. In Michael's case, you know, immediately he began abusing Wade. He told him it had to be their secret and he could never tell anyone. If he told anyone, they'd go to jail, etc., and sort of rehearsed what to do if asked by parents or by police.
Jackson allegedly also took advantage of the boys' families, especially their mothers, Joy Robson and Stephanie Safechuck. They were all too eager to think that Jackson's attention was a great honor, a terrific opportunity for their children, and even as they were increasingly separated from their kids, somehow harmless.
As Stephanie Safechuck says, James's mom, it was a fairy tale and we got sucked into it.
I came to feel like he was one of my sons by how he behaved. I loved him. He was a son I started to take care for. He would spend the night, I'd wash his clothes.
People's reaction, particularly women's reaction, is like, what the hell were the mums thinking? You know, how could they do this? That's why the film's 4 hours long, is you have to understand the relationships and the history of both these families in order to get to a point where you can certainly not condone and certainly not justify, but understand why these women did what they did. They just were dazzled, and they, you know, particularly Joy, relied on her son to tell her. You know, you say to your child, tell me if anything bad's happening. Well, you know, the kind of relationship a grooming predator forms with the victim is not perceived as abuse. And so in Wade's eyes, he would never do anything that would land Michael in jail.
As the documentary maintains, Michael Jackson made the boys feel far from ordinary, extremely special. And his interest in them was intoxicating. Here's Wade Robson in Leaving Neverland.
He was one of the kindest, most gentle, loving, caring people I knew. He helped me tremendously. He helped me with my career. He helped me with my creativity, with all of those sorts of things. And he also sexually abused me for 7 years.
In 2005, Michael Jackson was acquitted of sexually abusing another young boy. Robson testified for Jackson's defense, but now he says he lied in his testimony.
It's normal for people to say, well, there's a huge contradiction between what Wade said in May 2005 and what he's saying today. Of course, people will say that. But what they don't understand is that deep attachment that forms between the abuser and the victim in child sexual abuse, and how that bond can continue into much later life and can basically mean that the victim, the survivor, is locked in silence and cannot confront and doesn't want to confront and values the abusive relationship. You know, and this is the tragedy of it. So my answer is, like, watch the film. If you want to know why Wade contradicted what he said back in 2005, watch the film, because we do explain it, and we explain it, I think, very satisfactorily.
At the end of the documentary, it's impossible not to think of Jackson and his music in a new light. And what does that mean? Do you change the channel if one of his songs comes on the radio? Should the producers of a planned Michael Jackson musical abandon the idea? Can you judge the artist but not his or her music? Here's director Dan Reed.
You know, Michael was an amazing entertainer. And his music is part of the fabric of American life and part of is the soundtrack to so many precious memories for so many people. So, you know, I'm definitely not advocating ripping that out. You know, what do you do with art when the maker of the art is a flawed or even an evil person? Do you discard it? I don't know how much art would we have left if we conducted an audit of all the artists out there.
That was Dan Reed, the director and producer of the HBO documentary Leaving Neverland. Part one aired last night. Part two debuts tonight. Meanwhile, the Michael Jackson estate posted live from Bucharest a two-hour-long concert on its YouTube page last night. And tonight, they'll post another concert video live from Wembley. Coming up on The Frame, a chamber work dedicated to the controversial photography of Robert Mapplethorpe. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the fall of 1990, protesters took to the streets in Cincinnati in defense of art.
Art on trial! Art on trial!
Art on trial. That's what the 200 protesters outside the courthouse were saying, and they were saying art on trial is an outrage.
At the time, The Perfect Moment, an exhibition of photography by Robert Mapplethorpe, was on display at the Cincinnati Contemporary Art Center, and the center and its director, Dennis Berry, were indicted for obscenity over 7 images in the exhibit that displayed nudity and graphic depictions of sadomasochism.
In the conservative community, which is Cincinnati, the gay movement has not been particularly vocal politically in years gone by, but what happened here today is obvious proof that that is changing.
The obscenity trial sparked a national debate over gay rights, as well as perceptions of art and public funding, and what constituted obscenity. The jury's verdict, not guilty on all charges. The Mapplethorpe obscenity trial is now the subject of a new musical work called Triptych, Eyes of One on Another. It's a multimedia composition for a chamber orchestra and a vocal ensemble performed in front of projections of some of Mapplethorpe's images. Triptych was conceived of and composed by Bryce Dessner from the rock band The National, with a libretto by Cord Arrington Tuttle, in collaboration with the Mapplethorpe Foundation. I recently spoke with director Kaneza Shaul and Bryce Dessner about the piece, and for Dessner, the Mapplethorpe obscenity trial has a place in his own personal history.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Cincinnati and was a 14-year-old when those events played out. And really, kind of those events, you know, marked me in my sort of early years of thinking about art and all kinds of issues, really.
And it wasn't just about Robert Mapplethorpe. It was about who gets to decide what is and is not acceptable art. And it had broader implications beyond visual art. It touched on pop music. So it was a really turning point in how art is defined and the government's relationship to what it wanted to fund. So how did those further conversations start to become central to Triptych?
for me, it was more, you know, those events were my doorway into Mapplethorpe and something that stuck with me. And I wasn't sure when we started working on this, you know, working with Kaneza and working with our librettist, Cora Darrington Tuttle, how much the trial itself would play into the piece. It didn't end up coming, you know, the seconds, it's a triptych, and the second section does have a kind of basis in some of the trial language. So it is in the work in a poetic form.
In thinking about obscenity and in thinking about how we image the erotic in contemporary culture, I'm very excited in the work by the kind of tenderness and intimacy that exists in the photographs, the kind of questions around consent, particularly in the S&M photos. And so we have this opportunity to bring our own gaze, as it were, onto Mapplethorpe's photos. And it's been thrilling to have that exchange with Bryce and Cord and the team.
Kaneza, I want to ask you a little bit about criminal justice. Last year, you won the Art for Justice Fund Award from the Ford Foundation. You've done a stage work about prison reentry programs. Do you see a thread between your larger body of work and Triptych and the story of the Mapplethorpe trial?
When we are confronted with controversial artists or problematic works, our tendency as a society has been to erase them. And I am very interested in addressing those works. We have Mapplethorpe's body of art with all of its problematic glory, and finding ways to enter that as Black artists, as woman artists, as queer artists, and think about another generation of addressing the kind of classical nature of his photography is part of what excites me about the project.
As the director, you have an orchestra, you have a libretto, you have a vocal ensemble, you have projections. How do they all start to knit together into a coherent whole? And what was your approach about bringing those seemingly disparate elements all together?
One of the many strengths of the project is that we have many different artists working who are coming to this body of work and to Mapplethorpe with unique interests, curiosities, questions. So I see my job as holding all of that contradiction, holding the places we agree, holding the places we disagree as a large tapestry and seeing to it that that tapestry doesn't tear.
And Bryce, when you're starting to think about the sound of this story, where do you start? Do you start with an orchestration? Do you start with a theme? How does the music reveal itself to you?
I mean, I heard some things before I saw words. I would say that mostly Cord Arrington Tuttle's libretto is extremely musical, and so that many of the sections of it make themselves known to me. And, you know, it could be a melodic idea or a rhythmic device, and sometimes it's something more general.
What appears to be a man pleasuring himself, dirt caked beneath his nails.
Another doorway for me, in addition to the trial, was thinking about Mapplethorpe as a classical artist and his interest in Italian mannerism. And so there's a beautiful, in terms of, you know, working with a vocal ensemble, the tradition of Italian madrigal is obviously a really profound one. And also there's, you know, many erotic madrigals, and it's a kind of music you can kind of put next to Mapplethorpe. That said, that, you know, the piece goes in and out of various musical styles, some that would sound more like the way I would write orchestrally. Others have American idioms in them, you know, that different singing styles. Room Full of Teeth are incredibly versatile, and our two soloists, Alicia Moran and Isaiah Robinson. So there's all kinds of singing in the work.
We're talking with Bryce Dessner, the composer, and Kaneza Shaw, the director, about Triptych, Eyes of One on Another. The LA Phil program notes for this show says, and I'm quoting now, "This production contains sexually explicit content that may be inappropriate for attendees under 18. And obviously, Mapplethorpe's photographs can be challenging to a lot of people. But does that warning get at the heart of, like, why do you have to be 19 to see these photos? Why is this specific to a certain age where you can look at these photos and not be somehow hurt by them?
I find it stunning that Mapplethorpe's work is still so shocking to people in an contemporary imaging culture where very graphic sexual content is one click away. And I've been thinking about that a lot in sitting with the photos. One of the things that really strikes me is the intimacy and the tenderness and how consent comes up as a question in the photographs. I feel like in our contemporary landscape, so much of the imaging of the erotic has to do with blurry consent lines, has to do with a distance between people viewing intimacy. And I'm excited about how vulnerability lives in this work and human closeness and tenderness.
And when you think about the way that people might watch this show, is it your hope that they might not only re-examine their own feelings about what is shocking and what is beautiful, but also see Mapplethorpe's art as art and not as a referendum on obscenity?
I mean, I think that the beauty of these images continues to reveal itself, and that includes the most provocative ones and the simplest ones, the images of flowers or classical busts. And also, you know, it's different from kind of sneaking around a gallery or flipping quickly through a photo book or something, which is most of how people would have, you know, seen these images before. So I think for sure there's a different kind of energy that's going to be at play, and that's part of what we're really interested in.
As creative artists, Bryce, maybe writing and recording a piece of music, Kaneza staging a theatrical experience, when you're doing something like this with so many different elements, a multimedia presentation, does it change the way that you think about the subject? Are you re-examining your own assumptions about Mapplethorpe and what you think about the artist as you're going through the process of creating this show?
I am a child of the 80s. I grew up in San Francisco. There was a tight-knit community around my family that included 10 gay men. 8 of them were dead by the time I was 6. And I remember the smell of bodies dying. And I remember the quilt. And I remember the kind of going out parties before someone passed to kind of celebrate people's lives before they died. And there was this sweetness and terror and pounding grief. Having this time with the music that Bryce has gifted the world and these words from Chord and the images, for me, is an entry point into the presence of a lost generation.
Bryce, what about you?
There's a moment deep in the piece where I do feel so much love and humanity and, you know, that all these conflicts and contradictions that are in those photographs and the way they were made. That's the kind of primary feeling that I inhabit when I'm sitting with the work.
Bryce Dessner is the composer. Kaneza Shawl is the director of Triptych Eyes of One on Another. Bryce and Kaneza, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bryce Dessner's concert version of Triptych premieres on March 5th at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Coming up on The Frame, a bizarre musical instrument turns 100, and we're celebrating its birth.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Oh my God, the car is sliding!
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, the rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. One of the quirkier and more misunderstood musical instruments turns 100 this year. The theremin makes a sound you instantly recognize, but most of us don't know anything about its history or its potential. Frame contributor Tim Grieving set out to fix that.
The theremin basically looks like a small podium with two metal antennae that create an electromagnetic field. The musician never actually touches the antenna, but forms a capacitor by waving his or her hands. The vertical antenna on the right side controls pitch, so the closer your hand gets, the higher the note. The looped one on the left side controls volume, so the farther away your hand moves from it, the louder the sound. The theremin is a relatively young instrument. It was invented by a Russian physicist and cellist named Leon Theremin in
1919.
People say he wanted to invent an instrument which was so easy to play you don't even have to touch it while you play it.
Carolina Eich is in a rare club. She plays the theremin, and has since she was 7 years old.
He was experimenting in his laboratory and found out that you can change capacity when you wave your hand in front of a metal antenna.
It was one of the first electronic instruments, and it brought the space age into the concert hall. Theremin took his invention to New York in 1927, and he patented the theremin in 1928. American audiences were enchanted.
Pretty soon, the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, started to build theremin's instruments. And we have a very lively time in the 30s, where classical musicians picked up the instrument, violinists like Clara Rockmore, who even got pieces commissioned for theremin and orchestra, which were performed in the Carnegie Hall.
The Song of Grusia by Rachmaninoff.
This is an older Clara Rockmore playing in 1977. Rockmore was a star violinist from Russia who came to the U.S. in 1921. She met Leon Theremin a few years later, and they even dated for a while. Rockmore treated the theremin like a violin, and she made it famous in a serious way.
And at that time, I still had to prove to the world that the theremin instrument was not just a magic toy and a wonderful gadget, and that it was a serious musical instrument, seriously taken.
Then along came Hollywood.
That's the only thing that they wanted to make weird noises, and it is spooky. You were supposed to be frightened by the sounds and all that, and that was not what I wanted to add to. I just wanted to be a serious musician, play Bach.
In the 1940s and 50s, the theremin was used in several film scores, but in a way that emphasized its spooky, otherworldly qualities, like in this section for Bernard Herrmann's score for The Day the Earth Stood Still. When that era ended, the theremin more or less fell by the wayside. Well, except for the time Brian Wilson used the sound of one in Good Vibrations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. But recently, the theremin has been making a bit of a comeback. When composer Justin Hurwitz began discussing the music for the 2018 film First Man with director Damien Chazelle, they thought it might be perfect for the story of Neil Armstrong's mission to the moon, but not for the more obvious reasons.
One thing we talked about from the beginning is how the theremin is so associated with 50s and 60s sci-fi, but we wondered, could it be used in a really emotional way? Could it be used in a really melodic way? So I got a theremin and started trying our melody, our main theme melody on it, and I was really taken with how expressive the instrument can be. And in particular, how emotional our melody played on it. I really loved how it had certain qualities of a human voice. It could sound like singing or crying or wailing.
Meanwhile, Carolina Eich is tapping into the unexplored potential of the theremin. Using loop pedals and her voice, she creates music for the instrument that takes it into undiscovered territory. I wish you could see her play it. She looks like a sorcerer casting spells in the air. As a teenager growing up in Germany, Eich developed her own techniques for measuring the air, and her precise hand gestures almost look like sign language.
The playing technique really has developed in the past years. Before, when people would take a music piece from the violin or something, or from a singer, they would try to imitate the violin or a singer. Now we are finding own ways and let the theremin speak its own language.
Composers are writing new concert works for theremin and orchestra. Eich just premiered one in Brussels, and she has another premiere in Albany this fall. She says, ever since she was a little girl, the theremin has been liberating.
Playing an instrument which almost nobody knows in the audience gives you an enormous freedom to just perform and be sure that you're not being judged. And that gave me freedom for my music, for my creativity. So it, in many ways, it was a guide or a friend, a teacher all the way.
So happy birthday, theremin. And if you're so inclined, you can buy one today at Guitar Center for about $500. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.